On RN, this is Counterpoint. Hi, I'm Amanda Vanstone. On today's program, we'll be talking about the north of Australia. It's been in the news a lot lately, with mining entrepreneurs and politicians calling for tax breaks and other incentives for people to move there, work there and invest there. Missing from that conversation is what the people who actually live there think. That is, until now. Also today, well look, I have to admit, I'm currently a little bit obsessed by a game that I can play on my phone. It's called Candy Crush. And once I start, I find it very, very difficult to put it down. But it is, I think, essentially harmless, apart from being a complete time waster. Other games are not. They can have a serious effect on possibly adults, but certainly on children. So, for the moment, put down your phone, get away from that joystick, and we'll find out why a bit later. But first, with matters arising in Europe, from London, Counterpoint regular Brendan O'Neill. If you joined us last month for our European update, you would have heard us talking about the German election. And one aspect of that was whether we should be calling Angela Merkel Angela Merkiavelli, because she was pretty good at having one persona at home and another abroad. At the time, the suggestion was the race would be close, but it hasn't turned out that way. And joining me now to discuss that and other matters is our regular correspondent, Brendan. Welcome.
Hi there.
Well, what's the story with Angela Merkel? There she is. On a knife edge, people say, turns out not to be the case. Nearly as good a vote as Chancellor Kohl just after reunification. I mean, a terrific result. Absolutely squashed her opposition.
Yeah, she has done fantastically well. I mean, she swept the opposition aside. She got about 42% of the vote, I think, her bloc. The one downside for her is that her coalition partners in the Free Democratic Party did terribly, and in fact they won't have any national representation in parliament in Germany for the first time in the post-war era. So
Is that because they have a minimum percentage you have to get before you can take a seat?
That's right, yeah, you need a certain percentage before you can be represented in parliament, and I think the Free Democratic Party got less than 5%.
Well, do you see, there is actually some discussion, of which I am keen to promote, as to whether we should do that in the Australian Senate, because we've just had, as you know, our election, and the third senator in each state can end up being someone who, you know, started off with less than 2,000 votes. And one way to stop that would be to follow the German example and say, well, look, there's a minimum percentage you have to get, and if you don't get that percentage, you can't collect preferences and you can't take a seat.
Yeah, I think that's a sensible way to go. And I think because what the result reflects in Germany is it reflects people's outlook, and their outlook is pro-Merkel. It wasn't necessarily that they were massive fans of the coalition that she had, that she governed with over the past few years. It's that they like her as a person. And I think what's become clear in the election is that the reason they like her is because, this is going to sound terribly sexist, but because they see her as a mother figure. And in fact, it's very interesting because initially when she first came on the political scene, people called her Mother Merkel as an insult to try and put her down and say that she was just this mumsy character who had no place in politics. But during the recent election campaign, and in fact over the past few years, Merkel has turned that to her advantage. And now you will see lots of her youthful supporters in particular saying, "We love you, Mother Merkel." And she has turned that insult into a kind of badge of pride. And I think one of the reasons the German people opted for her is because at this rather hairy moment in European history, particularly in terms of economics, they want a safe pair of hands. And she advertised herself as the clear-minded, disciplinarian mother type who would look after the German nation in this rough period.
Well, she's always had a persona of being calm, but in control, I would say, as opposed to authoritarian.
Yeah.
And in difficult times, perhaps even in good times, we all need leaders who are calm and who are, because of the calmness, in control.
Yeah, well, she's so much calmer and more in control than other Western European leaders. It's really amazing. If you look at David Cameron is always blustering around and coming up with new policies and new PR statements, or you have Hollande in France, who doesn't really know what he stands for and has become a bit of a joke over the past few months, whereas Merkel is much calmer and clearer. And people have a tendency to put it down to her gender. And she has played on that a little bit in recent years, which is, I think, a bit of a shame, because I don't think this is a gender issue. It's the fact that she has a clearer idea than those other politicians of what she and her party stand for and what they want to do. So fundamentally, I think her calmness reflects the fact that she has a longer-term vision for what she wants to do, which is something that these other male politicians don't have at the moment.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to the story about Muslim veils. This has caused significant discussion, heavens above, all over the world, where there are various forms of limitation on the wearing of the complete veil. And you in particular have had quite a bit to say about this. Because I can see that it's really got up your gander, one might say. And in particular, you're concerned about why it is that we're so upset about a little piece of cloth.
Yeah, I think Western Europe in particular has become pretty obsessed with the veil over the past 3 or 4 years, which is really interesting because if you look at the numbers in these countries that are obsessed with the veil, the number of women who wear it are very small. I mean, there are lots of women in Britain, France, Belgium and other countries who wear the veil that covers their hair. That's quite common. You will definitely see, every time you walk through London, you will see a woman who covers her hair with a veil. But seeing a woman who completely covers her face is still very rare. But in these countries where people are obsessed with the face veil, the numbers are very small. So it's estimated, for example, that in France, about 350 women, maybe up to possibly 500, wear the full face veil. In Belgium, it's a very small number, and yet both of those countries have taken the decision to ban the full face veil in public as if it were a huge national problem. It's very hard to tell how many women wear the full veil in Britain because there are no actual statistics, but we can assume that it's probably also quite a small number. And yet here, over the past month, there has also been a really quite hysterical debate about it. So I'm interested in the fact that the evidence doesn't back up this hysteria, and it's not a massive problem, so why do we keep talking about it?
Well, you go a bit further than that, though, I think, and point out that perhaps we've lost our way in terms of being enlightened.
Yes. I think the key driving force behind this is that political leaders and thinkers and various other people in Western countries find it really hard these days to say what we are for, to say what Western values are, to say that we still have an attachment to the Enlightenment and to the ideal of universalism and rationalism. All those things have become terribly unfashionable in recent years because of postmodernism and relativism and environmentalism and all these other kind of unenlightened views, as I would see them. So what the veil debate offers politicians in particular is an opportunity to say, well, we're more enlightened than that. We don't really know what we're for. We can't really explain what our values are, but at least we can say, we don't like the burqa, we don't like the niqab, we're slightly more civilized than people who completely cover their faces. So I think there's a large element of enlightenment posturing in relation to this, where politicians can kind of get their moral rocks off by saying, you know, we might be confused about our values, we might not know what it means to be a citizen anymore, but at least we know we don't like the idea of women draping themselves in black cloth. So there's a lot of opportunism here, I think.
It's a very neat way to highlight how little we've got to say about ourselves, or how little we can say about ourselves.
I should point out that I don't like the burqa at all, or the niqab, and when I see women in London wearing them, I always bulk a little bit, and I always think, oh, why have you got that on? But there's a number of issues with it. The first thing is that lots of young British-born Muslim women are now wearing the niqab, even though their mothers, their own mothers who came from foreign countries, didn't wear it at all. So it's become a bit of a fashion statement, and in fact, you will often see in trendy shops, you will see very young British women with British accents wearing the full face veil as they shop for skinny jeans or high heel shoes. So the idea that it's a purely exotic foreign thing doesn't quite add up. A lot of this controversy in Britain sprung from the fact that a woman tried to argue that she should be allowed to wear the full veil in court while giving evidence. She's up on charges. And in those instances, I would completely support the right of a judge or a tutor in a university to say, no, you can't wear the veil. You can't wear the veil in this courtroom. You can't wear the veil in my classroom. There are instances, I think, when you have to be able to see someone's face. When they're giving evidence is one example. When they're talking to their university tutor could be another. But I think what I would be opposed to is a full blanket ban across the whole public of the kind that they've had in France, because I think that's just unnecessarily authoritarian.
Mm. It's true as well that all the fuss about this, made by people who, I'm not wanting to be unkind about them, but want to present themselves as, you know, people who want to do the right thing. You know, I'm protective of this poor Muslim woman who has to wear this clothing. In fact, making such a fuss about it doesn't actually help them much.
No, not at all. I think, in fact, you know, to the extent that there are some women in Western Europe who are under cultural pressure to wear the full veil, and that is no doubt the case, it's not helping them at all, because you're effectively forcing them to stay at home. If these women or their husbands or their families truly believe that it's wrong for a woman to show her face in public, and you ban the covering of faces in public, then you're forcing that woman to become a prisoner in her own home and never to be able to go out. I think that's really damaging and dangerous and will alienate these women even more. I think if we want to help female Muslim immigrants who wear peculiar clothing, there are lots of things we could do. We could offer them education, we could offer them jobs, we could try to talk to them about childcare and other things that they might benefit from. It's not useful just to say to them, rip off your niqab, because I think that just forces them to stay indoors.
Mm. Well, let's move on to Russia and Putin in particular.
Mm.
Do you think we're seeing the commencement of a new world order with Russia and the United States coming together to talk in Geneva about what can be done?
I think what Putin has done over Syria is really interesting, because I think he's really got one over on America. And he did this really interesting thing where he wrote a piece for the New York Times, you know, the kind of the newspaper of liberal opinion in America, the kind of Obama newspaper, the newspaper that every intelligent American reads. Putin wrote an actual piece for them in which he really criticized America over Syria and really said that it was behaving badly, it was behaving irrationally, it doesn't know what it's doing anymore. And he had a lot of support in the West, including in Western liberal circles, which aren't normally fond of Russian authoritarian leaders. So I think Putin has done very well out of Syria. And I think the reason he has done very well is because Britain and America's threatened strikes against Assad's regime were made very haphazardly. They didn't have much support in the West at all. For example, in the British Parliament, our MPs voted down David Cameron's proposal to bomb Syria. So I think it highlights the weakness and confusions of certain Western governments. And Putin has been able to milk that, and he's been able to take advantage of that. And he has now fairly successfully had a makeover as this kind of decent, diplomatic, sensible guy.
Mm. That all may be true, but there's another aspect to this, and that is, what kind of victory is this? You know, now he's got friends in Syria. Great. Not necessarily the people you want to have as your best ally, and not necessarily the most useful people for him to be cozying up with.
True, and, you know, I think Putin's behaviour in relation to Syria has been pretty bad, as well as, I think, Western government's behaviour has been pretty bad as well. But what Putin is doing in Syria, I think, is quite ruthlessly pursuing his own national interests. I think he's worked out that his interests lie in keeping Assad in place and allowing Assad to brutally suppress any kind of jihadist threat, because he wants to keep Syria relatively stable, and he wants to do that in order to keep Iran relatively stable. So he's got his eye on regional stability that he thinks will benefit Russia. And he's made it pretty clear that he will support any kind of terrible, terrible behaviour on Assad's part to preserve that. So I think that's what's driving him. But as a spin-off from that, what's interesting is that in the West itself, he has won this new kind of respect, which is quite perverse and a bit weird, but it's a respect based on the idea that he has acted rationally in relation to Syria, whereas the West acted irrationally. So he hasn't exactly won friends in the West, but he has won a certain amount of admiration that he did not have before this.
Well, look, if you had to choose between friends and respect, which would you choose? I can tell you right now, I'd choose the latter.
Yes.
And I think any world leader would, without doubt. Well, you might have seen the article entitled Putin is winning on Snowden, Syria and Sochi, but you know, with the games, they're way over budget, corrupt as one can ever begin to imagine. Syria, not okay, some respect, but not great advantage other than that. And then Snowden, you know, unlike the Chinese who kept him long enough to see if he had anything to give them and then parceled him off to Russia, these seem to be, in one sense, pretty short-term victories for Putin.
They are short-term victories, I think. And in a sense, the fact that Putin is celebrating these things by writing to the New York Times and everything else also shows that he is a bit desperate, actually. He's a bit desperate for some kind of respect from the West. So if you kind of dig at these stories and look beneath them, you will see that Putin is on fairly shaky ground himself. And as you say, these are short-term, surface-driven victories. But I think what we're seeing potentially is the replaying of the Cold War in a really shallow way. You know, the Cold War, which lasted 40 or 50 years, at least had some substance to it. At least was a clash of values between America, which posed as democratic and free, and Russia, which claimed to be rational and reasoned and driven to hard work. There was something behind the Cold War. And we're seeing, I think, the resurrection of the Cold War, the resurrection of the West versus East standoff, but over much flimsier issues, over a whistleblower who has done a runner to Russia, over the question of who is behaving better in relation to Syria. So I think we're seeing East-West tensions coming back into the global sphere in a quite explicit way, but the things that are at stake are much smaller and shallower than they were in the past.
Can we just briefly touch on fascism in Greece, apparently raising its ugly head? And one wonders why people think it's a good idea to call a fascist party Golden Dawn.
Good question. And I think, yes, there is an issue in Greece with Golden Dawn. They are a vicious party. They have horrible beliefs, particularly about Jews and immigrants. And one of their supporters did recently kill a very popular left-wing Greek rapper, which was an extremely shocking act. But I do think we need to put them into some kind of perspective, however difficult it might be. And the fact is that they had about 7% of support at the last election, which is not massive. And I think that the current discussion about the Greek state banning Golden Dawn is really dangerous, because what you do if you allow the state to ban certain political parties is that you are giving the state the right to determine the parameters of politics and what it's acceptable to believe and who it's acceptable for people to vote for. So I think however much Greek people might understandably loathe Golden Dawn, they really must resist the temptation to call on the government to ban political parties they don't like. I think that is a very dangerous road to go down.
Well, we faced that here, of course, when I had some time in government with a woman called Pauline Hanson. The then Prime Minister had her kicked out of the Liberal Party. That's fair enough, because she was not espousing views that were liberal. But many people said she shouldn't be allowed to say that. Well, really, it's, as you say, a very dangerous road to go down. People should be able to say things. The requirement then is on the rest of us, of course, to gang together and say, we don't agree with you, and we think you're wrong, and we hate you, and we're never going to vote for you.
Absolutely. You know, the response to people who spout hate speech or stupid political ideas is always to have more speech, more activism, more people saying you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, not less. You know, the worst response is to try to restrict what people can say. And I think we do need to get the whole far-right problem in perspective in Europe, because when the recession kicked off, there was a lot of discussion, you know, there's going to be the rise of the far-right, they're going to go crazy, just like they have in earlier economic downturns. But the fact is that in most European countries, including the East, in Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, there has actually been a downturn in support for far-right parties over the past 4 years. In other countries, there has been a rise in support, for example, in Austria, Hungary, Finland. But even there, it's always been around 10%, a 10% shift in the favour of these quite small parties. So the idea that Europe is going to be taken over by far-right parties like Golden Dawn is just not true. So let's not overreact to one horrible little party and empower European governments to tell us what kind of politics we can support.
Indeed. What a nice point to end our discussion this month on. Quite an important point to make. Let's not let the little rat bags upset the rest of us.
Yes.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Amanda.
And Brendan O'Neill is the editor of Spiked in London and an occasional writer for The Australian. And he'll be back next month with more from Europe. On RN, you're listening to Counterpoint with me, Amanda Vanstone. And up next, we're going north to discover why lately everyone wants us to go, well, north. Being called the land from down under means we think of ourselves as the mighty southern land. But of course, there's a northern part to that southern land. It featured recently in our federal election. And our guest today has got a lot to say about what we ought to do to get maximum advantage out of the north and to give the north that which it deserves. Welcome, Alan Dale.
Hello, Amanda.
Well, you point out lots of things about the Territory, and not just the Northern Territory, the whole North. And you want to say, hey, look, these are the three really important things I want you to understand about what has to happen. What would you say?
I'd have to say, why would we want to really think seriously about the way we govern Northern Australia? And there's quite a few very foundation reasons why I think that's critical. Some of those include the fact that a lot of the economic development that Australia's sort of been experiencing the last 4 or 5 years depends on that. Some of our greatest natural and environmental assets. It's got some of our greatest poverty. It's got some of the greatest opportunity in terms of our relationships with Asia and so forth. So that's the why we need to think about. How do we really govern Northern Australia? The second reason is really because how do we do it at the moment? It's very fragmented. To a certain extent, there's four different jurisdictions that basically have broad responsibility for Northern Australia, and a lot of the power base from that foundation sits down in the south. And thirdly, we have huge opportunities to get this right. The future of Northern Australia can be extremely rosy, a very diverse place, a great place to live, a fantastic lifestyle. But if we get it wrong, we've got some really bad outcomes potentially on our doorstep. A very serious boom and bust economy. Maybe one with more bust and less boom. Some of the crown environmental and cultural assets we've got not kept to the sort of degree of integrity that they need to be. And finally, some of those big issues about poverty, almost the potential to sort of see a failed state emerging in parts of Northern Australia. So the stakes are very high, but the opportunities are great as well. And that's why we've put this focus into, let's start this debate about the governance of Northern Australia. Get a national debate, perfect timing, because there's about to unfold a long national debate through this proposed white paper that the new coalition government is proposing.
Yep.
So it's perfect timing to start a national discussion, but it's also perfect timing to start that discussion from Northern Australia itself, rather than waiting for that debate to happen within Southern Australia.
Sure. Some of the things you've said, though, apply to other places. For example, most decisions about federal government things that relate to South Australia are made by predominantly people from the eastern seaboard. I mean, none of us really get the pleasure of controlling ourselves. That's one of the great benefits of a federation, that we all come together and make these decisions. Do you really think Northern Australia should be treated differently from the other states?
Look, I think these sort of issues play out in different ways at different times. You could also sort of say it's almost a rural-urban issue in terms of governance between the city and the bush. So you're right, there is a generic sort of set of issues facing east, west, bush, city. But the reason we've really got to sort of grab this one, I think at this particular point in time, is that some of the opportunities are so great and some of the risks are so great that if we don't give that focus to Northern Australia, then we really probably create a problem that will take many, many years to sort of unravel and rectify. I'd really bring to the top of the list there that sense of what is our relationship with not just Southeast Asia, but the wider tropics? How do we really sort of see ourselves take advantage of this huge emerging opportunity about tropical knowledge, about export and development across Northern Australia, as well as this incredible interest in, you know, people buying into, if you like, the sort of level of foreign investment interest in Northern Australia? Those pressures are just about to start in a very, very significant way. The second is the fact, I think, from a human rights and a social justice point of view, the long-held issues of poverty facing many North Australian communities really is one of those things that is a national emergency to deal with, you know. So we can't let those sorts of problems as well as those sorts of opportunities lag. We've got to be able to put the opportunity and a bit of focus into the North, and that's why I think it's become such a high-profile issue in the last election and why I think the Coalition's putting so much effort into thinking about this through the white paper process.
Sure. Can you help me with what you would use as a loose definition of Northern Australia? I mean, I'm instinctively going to refer to the territory, probably because it starts with North.
Yeah.
But you mean a much broader area than that. So for the purposes of the rest of the discussion, can we just clarify what you're talking about when you talk about Northern Australia?
Pretty simple. That line from the bull at Rockhampton right across the Tropic of Capricorn. As you say, though, you know, you could look at it a little bit as a urban, remote, arid lands versus the rest, but for the purposes of what we're talking about, we're really talking about north of the tropics.
Sure. Can we just focus on the Indigenous aspect mm-hmm. for a part of the time? Because yep. Indigenous people have truly suffered from people who mean well. You know, people on both sides of the political spectrum have, of course, meant well. But we've had a variety of services from, you know, assimilation to self-determination, and neither have produced what everyone wants for Indigenous Australians, and that's a fair share of Australia's social and economic wealth and a chance for the kids to develop their full potential. What are the issues, including dealing with land issues, that we need to sort out, especially as it relates to the North?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why this governance paper deals with the whole issue of Indigenous development very, very significantly as part of the future of the governance of Northern Australia. And the first and foremost thing that I think I try to make very clear on that is that North Australia is largely an Indigenous domain. And we have little pockets, if you like, of freehold, but the vast majority, some 94%, has some form of Indigenous interest in terms of land and land tenure, whether it's Indigenous held land or communal tenure or leasehold-based land, which is potentially subject to native title or actually subject to native title. So it's one of the reasons why we have to see that as a foundation about the future of Northern Australian development. I'd say first and foremost is coming to understand some of the complexities and differences in Indigenous governance across Northern Australia. A lot of the programmatic histories that we've been through, as you're saying, from assimilation through to self-determination and now more that normalisation sort of agenda of the last number of years, hasn't quite come to grips with the fact that there are multiple forms of Indigenous governance. There's the foundation, traditional and led governance systems. Those are the basic ways of doing things culturally and appropriately. There's the foundations of the Indigenous service sector that's dealing with a lot of the broad health and community services and housing sort of agendas. And then there's Indigenous local government in its own right. So Indigenous councils or Indigenous led councils. Torres Strait, again, is something quite different to other parts of Northern Australia. So we have to come to terms, I suppose, with that complexity and invest in the governance, all of those components, and to support them to come together in a much more integrated way, to work much more effectively for the future of those communities. That's one issue. The second, for me, comes down to the fact that the focus has been almost solely within communities. And so the bigger issue of what drives economic development and social development, actually supporting regional development in a broader sense, tends to get left off that agenda. So we see a big focus on sorting out issues at a community level when some of the big economic solutions might be much more fundamentally regional or to deal with large mining enterprises or institutions, agricultural development, social and human service sector development. So we've got to be able to start to look at the governance in a regional sense, cross Northern Australian sense, to lift up the economic development required to actually support people escaping poverty. The third and foremost thing we'd say is pretty much around this issue of tenure, as you were saying. There's a bit of a perception, I suppose, that Indigenous tenures might be the anathema to economic development. But in reality, there are many things that can be done very effectively in supporting traditional owners to take advantage of the tenures that they have to facilitate development of various sorts from their point of view. The problem tends to be, though, that there's often not a broad agreement about what's possible at a wider scale within the landscape. So the conflicts that are there lead to a lack of interest in investment, joint ventures, all those sorts of things that might actually lead to development at that point. So we've got to solve some of those bigger regional issues to lift up the level of investment and confidence, deal with some of those very strong long-term governance issues, and really create the environment in which this type of joint venturing between development and traditional owners and broader communities is possible.
It's a sorry state of affairs when many people in Australia, including Indigenous Australians, when you say, oh, that's communally owned land, immediately come to the assumption that not much can be done there. But in fact, if you visit, as I did once, a number of First Nations in the United States and Canada, you can see enormous amounts can be done for the benefit of the particular groups that own the land on communal land.
Absolutely.
It can be done.
Absolutely.
But why don't we understand that?
I've been working in Northern Australia and particularly Indigenous development issues all of my life, and it's always amazed me that we're quite capable of dealing with these sorts of issues internationally, but we don't tend to have that sort of broader community-based and long-term development approach within Australia itself. And I'm not quite sure why that is in a lot of ways, but it is possible. And the foundations to securing that are really the support of getting the governance arrangements right in traditional owner-based communities, supporting traditional owners to decide where and how they want to develop, what their aspirations, what their priorities are, and really then building the capacity for people to start to be looking at those possibilities. The tenure is often the last issue, and there's fantastic development opportunities which are already occurring within Northern Australia where traditional owners are very successfully used, for example, the Aboriginal Land Rights Act leasing arrangements or other arrangements or possibilities that are possible under other bits of legislation.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. Can you give us a few examples of ones that are working well? Because, you know, the traditional media are happy to give us the stories that aren't working well.
Look, there's good little examples right across bits and pieces. It's a bit like a smattering across
just
all
a
Australia.
Few.
But some of the classic low-key ones that people quite often don't think about, some of the lease-based agreements in relation to major infrastructure projects like the Darwin to Adelaide sort of railway, where there's been some good deals done and resulting in some pretty good outcomes for traditional owners. Reform at the community level in terms of shifting towards a more market-based housing sort of approaches where deals are done with native title owners. Some of the leasing-based arrangements that have shifted for community facilities in the Northern Territory, they're all starting to move towards normalising the practice of getting things agreed, working out the right way for the tenure to actually be managed, and then generating the wealth and long-term wealth and income for traditional owners. We're only just at the start of that process. So my feel is one of the greatest opportunities that exists is really to start to concentrate on getting the preconditions right. And we probably haven't done that in the past, and that's why we haven't seen these sorts of developments occur.
Well, really, what you're saying is to develop things, resources in particular, for example, what we need at the commencement of the process is something that brings people together and resolves the conflict first up.
Absolutely. I described it a little bit like if we're in downtown Fitzroy or Melbourne or whatever the case, Adelaide, whatever the case may be, you have a strong council with strong resources. It has a clear land use plan. It has a clear infrastructure plan. It has a clear linkage, if you like, of the infrastructure required to service emerging land uses back into the budget cycle. If you think of Northern Australia, effectively it's a public landscape in a broader sense, public and communal landscape. So there isn't, if you like, that foundation that sort of says this is how we would encourage, if you like, the orderly and progressive development of economic activity, and we'll protect all those things that we need to look at in the landscape as well. That just doesn't happen in Northern Australia. If we can get those foundations right, those broad conflicts that are there between conservation, development, cultural heritage, whatever the case may be, can start to be sifted through. And that's the key to starting to lift the level of confidence from an investor's point of view. And I'd stress here, the investors are many and varied, from external foreign investment to Australian corporates, to Australian families, to traditional owners, to the conservation sector investing in conservation. All of those players are investors in the future of Northern Australia. Once that's there, there's that strong regional consensus, the foundations for dealing with native title interest and other interests is resolved, then the process can start to become very, very orderly and normal. Without that, getting the infrastructure we need, the targeted infrastructure we need, doesn't get scoped up, doesn't end up at state cabinet or federal cabinet, doesn't end up in the budget cycles of both of those governments. So it's a bit of a wait and see. Investors wait and see. Conservation sector sits on the outside, looks at what it's trying to achieve, and we end up with 20 years of conflict. And I just don't think that's achieving a great outcome for Northern Australia.
No. Well, I do recall that some Indigenous communities, I'm thinking of, I think it was Lockhart River, had something like 54 agreements with state, territory, local governments and federal government for things like provision of water and electricity and day-to-day stuff. You know, you sign an agreement with us, we'll deliver this. There's no person in the mainland coastal regions that has to go through that kind of bother in order to switch on a light.
Ah, this one comes down to one of those issues that's been at the heart of my passion for dealing with some of these reforms, Amanda, because our governance system is so fragmented that if I'm a council based in Aracoon or Lockhart or whatever the case may be, I worked in Aracoon for many years in the late 80s, early 90s, and effectively counted around about 70 agencies that would walk through the door of the Aracoon Airport, all with their own sort of programs, all with their own obligations and responsibilities. And you could just imagine that 90% of the effort for the council was about actually just dealing with the transaction cost.
The paperwork, yeah, sure. I mean, and imagine being, say you're not involved in these meetings, you're an innocent bystander, and you're sitting there and another light plane flies in.
Yep.
And another group of bureaucrats, and I don't say that in a pejorative sense, because they've been tasked to do it, fly in from another department with another story and another promise of making things better. I mean, if you need an example of the resilience of Indigenous Australians and their capacity to see it through, just go to any community and watch the number of people that fly in promising to make things better and them sitting there thinking, well, you know, let's give it another go. I mean, it really is a triumph of hope over history.
It is, and that's why I remain very, if you like, hopeful, I suppose, about
committed.
If we can see these sorts of real reforms within government systems, continuing building of the capacity of communities and traditional owners to really take their aspirations forward, long-term hard-haul community development, place-based community development, we might start to actually see some of these very intractable problems become very tractable quite quickly. That's the hope I would sort of see emerging from some real discussion about these types of reforms. I should stress too, this is not an issue purely for Indigenous communities in Northern Australia.
No.
This is an issue for Northern Australia as a whole. So it's a problem from the regional scale in Cairns to Broome, right down to the community scale in Aracoon and Lockhart. We all face this. And the overall design of programs on a very annualised, nationally competitive, non-partnership based, it sucks the capacity out of the communities because they've got to respond to so many things in a very non-strategic way. And we've got to shift that type of way of doing business.
Well, I'm a bit starstruck by what you've said because it so fits the reality of communities, but it is in particular Indigenous communities that perhaps the hearts and minds of Australians might be drawn to your thinking by focusing on them. Because, as we were discussing earlier, most communities in Australia, especially around the coast, couldn't imagine the administrative mess involved in coming together and finding a way for you locally to make 53 or 63 agreements just in order to get your community functioning. Yet we put this burden on those least equipped to manage that enormous administrative burden, and then we sit back and wonder why it doesn't work. Well, your paper, hopefully, will make a contribution to Australians, hopefully, coming together, thinking about Northern Australia, and in more complex ways than, oh, can't we get more people there, understanding what the real problems are in administering such a diverse range of opportunities and diverse range of peoples. It's been a pleasure having you today, and I hope you will join us again.
Thank you, Amanda.
That was the leader and associate professor of tropical regional development at the Cairns Institute at James Cook University, Alan Dale. I'm Amanda Vanstone. This is Counterpoint. And it's time to turn off the computer. Put your phone down now, because we're going to find out why games aren't always the harmless fun we want them to be. Well, if you're of my generation and you need something done technically in a digital or electronic sense, you call upon a younger person because they know everything. But the question is, do they know too much too soon? Joining me now is Michael Nagel from the University of the Sunshine Coast, and he has a view that young people don't need to be on iPads and every other technical whiz-bang thing at a very early age. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, what is the matter with little kids playing hairdressing games and cafe games and, you know, alligator bites your finger games on an iPad that are just enjoyable, fun, happy games?
I suppose there's nothing too terribly wrong with such an approach. I guess the problem is when technology is used as sort of panacea for enhancing learning or education, and increasingly it has a rather divine glow about it, saying, you know, if we get kids on iPads or computers sooner, that will help their academic prowess. And there isn't any evidence to support any of that.
Is there any evidence available as to how this might affect their brains?
Well, there is some. The American Pediatric Association has come flat out and said no children under the age of 2 or 3 should have access to technology because of the intensity of the screen. They think it's unhealthy. There are some researchers globally...
Let me interrupt you there. Why is an intensely bright screen unhealthy?
Well, there's some evidence...
I mean, the sunshine's very bright.
It is, but the intensity of the screen is such that it's a little bit different because sunlight can be muted in many ways, shapes, or form. But when you're looking at a screen, it's giving a great degree of intensity to the optic nerve. And there are some ophthalmologists and ophthalmological scientists who are saying, you know, because the eye is still developing at such an early age, that's probably not such a good thing. Now, there are also researchers who suggest that, you know, the whiz-bang quickness of games and such, it might actually hinder attention, you know, because it's asking people to move things very quickly and move things around. So I think the jury's still out into what some of those deficits are because the technology changes so quickly and it takes a while to get evidence from many studies.
Yes. Well, since you mentioned the eye is still developing when they're young, how long does that take to settle? And what about our brains? How long do they take to settle?
Well, my background isn't in ophthalmological science, but I do know a great deal about the human brain. And we do know that the brain doesn't fully mature till we're in our third decade of life. And it's incredibly vulnerable, I suppose, in the very early stages of life, you know, right from not long after conception, but particularly in the first few years of life. And during adolescence, when it goes through a complete restructuring process, and it changes markedly over an extended period of time.
And why does that mean technology, if we can loosely call it that, iPods, iPads, etc., are bad for kids under 3?
Well, I think, you know, the developing brain probably still needs a balanced diet, and one that's not only virtual. It also needs time for reading and other experiences that, you know, we know historically lead to the development of all facets of the mind. And so to simply suggest, as there are some who do, that, you know, technology is a great way for kids to learn all the time is problematic because most developmental psychologists will attest to the fact that it needs to be balanced. And I think probably more often than not now, kids are, the amount of time they're spending in screens seems to be increasing exponentially.
So what do you think is a fair thing for, say, children under 6? What's a fair thing in terms of the amount of time per day you might allow them to have kids' games,
right,
or come to the violent ones, but happy kids' games?
Right.
On an iPad, how much a day would you allow?
Well, most of the evidence that I've read suggests no more than 30 minutes to 45 minutes a day, maximum.
Gee.
Because there's so many other things that kids could be doing and should be doing.
Playing outside, for example.
Exactly. There's, you know, much of what kids learn in the world and how to deal with other people and much of their social emotional development happens in real life, not in virtual space.
Indeed. That's a very, very neat way to put it. Most of the development of life happens in the real world, not in the virtual world. So why let them sit in it all day?
Well, that's right. And, you know, again, the technology changes rapidly, and in order to get a real firm understanding of, you know, the positives and negatives, it takes quite some time for scientists to look at these things over a period of time. And we also have to be mindful that we can't set up, you know, experimental models that are going to look at pure causation. You know, you don't want to inundate kids and see how much it damages them. So a lot of the studies come through are sort of correlational findings and things that suggest, you know, we really need to balance things out and not be wrapped by this notion that technology is going to be all and end all.
Mm. Well, I understand what you said for the up to 6, you know, half an hour a day, 3 quarters at the most, good luck to the mothers and fathers of Australia with that.
Mm.
But what about 6 to 12? Would you allow more time then? And then if you could help us with teenagers. They're the ones that seem glued to this stuff.
Look, it's very difficult to make a blanket sort of nomination of time because it really depends on what kids are doing outside of that sphere as well. So
that's your balanced diet view. You know, you can have perhaps more of your iPad if you're doing a wider range of things away from technology.
No question. So if children are out doing things outside or young people are out doing things outside of, you know, looking at a screen, so involved with different recreational activities, sporting activities, school activities that don't necessarily dictate the use of technology, then probably having a fair bit of time on a computer or an iPad thing is not going to be as problematic. If, on the other hand, you know, a child is spending a disproportionate amount of time on a screen every day, day in and day out, then one, they're far more sedentary, so they're not getting any physical activity, and they become somewhat isolated, you know, in the real world again. Again, it's important to note, too, though, you know, that there are some positive applications with virtual worlds, and, you know, for a lot of kids who are a little bit introverted and young people, they can explore different worlds and being a different character, which helps build their self-concept and self-esteem. So it's all about moderation, I suspect, and making sure that kids aren't doing too much screen time and being mindful of what they're actually consuming.
One of the interesting points in an article referring to you, it wasn't an article you wrote, mentions that if kids spend too much time in this virtual world, what they don't get is a decent capacity to assess facial mannerisms because, you know, the raised eyebrow, the wink, the half smile, the little bit of a smirk, the slight facial expression change that we all use in meetings to recognise whether people are listening or interested, to engage with the world. They don't get that in the virtual world, and therefore they miss out and become less capable of dealing with their peers because they haven't learnt to pick up the signals that they might have learnt if they'd been, I don't know, out in the playground or the backyard playing with the neighbour's kids.
Well, that's quite true. And in fact, one of the gentlemen who was part of the research, Professor Gary Small from UCLA, was in Brisbane last year at a conference that I chaired. His group had actually looked at this and found that basically the more time you spent on a screen, the less capable you were of reading facial mannerisms in real time. Because a human face portrays a great deal of indicators in terms of emotion and a whole lot of factors. And if you spend too much time on screen, Professor Small's research suggests that you lose that capacity somewhat.
Mm. Can we move then away from the issue of the technology itself to what kids might access on that, and in particular to violent games, putting aside for the moment the view many may have that it's up to the parents to control access to those games. You've got some, I think, quite interesting points to make about kids who at a young age get to see a lot of virtual violence through these games. You have a real concern about that.
Well, I do, not least of which is because we know that, you know, if you grow up in a space where there's a lot of violence, it engages your flight or fight responses, and which in turn gets the body to do some amazing things. One of those is release high levels of cortisol. So people who are in chronically stressful environments have situations where cortisol is elevated, and it can shut down thinking and long term can actually damage particular regions of the brain. And we also know that violence is a huge factor in pushing levels of cortisol up, and that can be in real time or virtual time. We have studies that suggest that when young people, or any people for that matter, are playing particularly violent video games, it can engage the fight or flight response. And long term, that can have implications.
Mm. Well, there's one game I'm not aware of. I play very simple games on my phone on flights to reduce the time, something like Patience, for example, or one I wish I'd never come across called Candy Crush.
Mm.
Games like Grand Theft Auto are unfamiliar territory to me, but I'm told they're particularly violent, that people go and find someone, have sex with them, and then get more and more points according to the degree of violence with which they murder that person.
So that's true, and it's a very disturbing game because we have a growing body of evidence that tells us that when the more people play games like that, the more likely it is to become desensitized to that type of violence, and the more unlikely they are to see that type of violence as appalling. And their emotional response to that becomes less intense. So people playing those games, and there's a raft of evidence saying that when you play those games over time, one, it can make you more aggressive, and two, it can desensitize you to violence. And those games in particular have some real, arguably moral dilemmas in them, because it seems kind of odd that we would, you know, have a game where the more violent you are, the more points you gain. And as you mentioned, in that particular game, there's an opportunity to go out and kill a prostitute, a sex worker, after having sex with her. And the more violent you do and the quicker you do it and get your money back, the more points you get. And there's something deeply disturbing, for me anyway, in that kind of context.
Yes, I'm told it's R-rated in the United States, but not here. One does wonder why.
Yes, and while it's R-rated in the States, Dr. Wayne Warburton, who will be speaking at a conference that I'll be attending in the not-too-distant future in Sydney on media impact and the developing brain, notes that the number one consumers of that type of game in the United States are between the ages of 13 and 16. And if I'm not mistaken, I've seen reports where what's happened, you know, historically, we've had kids, maybe young kids who weren't old enough to purchase alcohol, hang out bottle shops and get somebody to purchase for them. We have stories like that happening in the States where 13 and 14-year-olds are hanging outside of video game stores and asking 18 or 19-year-olds to buy Grand Theft Auto for them.
Yes, and when you consider the proposition you put before, that is that your brain isn't fully developed until your third decade, sometime in that third decade, for people in the second decade to be accessing this sort of stuff is a bit of a problem. You know, this whole interview is worrying me, and it's worrying me because I'm 60, and when I was younger, I thought Mary Whitehouse was a complete, you know, wowser. But the older I get, the more I think she might have been right.
Well, I think, you know, as I said, the evidence is starting to accumulate, and there were a couple of really powerful studies that came out in the last few years that categorically said, you know, that research on exposure to television and movie violence suggests that playing violent video games increases aggressive behavior and desensitizes people to levels of violence that would normally be appalling.
Well, Michael, this is a worrying topic because I can understand no parent wants their kid to lag behind in access to technology. They don't want their kids to be the one in the class that says, oh, I don't know how to do that. But at the same time, overdoing it and letting your children have far too much access can be particularly damaging. Thanks very much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Michael Nagel is Associate Professor in the Faculty of Science, Health, Education and Engineering at the University of the Sunshine Coast. And that's Counterpoint for this week. Don't forget, you can go to abc.net.au/radionational, follow the prompts to Counterpoint, and that's where you can go to listen to the program again, hear a bit of it again, leave a message, or make a suggestion. Thanks for your company today. I'm Amanda Vanstone, and as always, until next week, arrivederci.